Bookend your day with Essential Listening. Breakfast and drive from 6am and PM on RN.
Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Today, mixed grills and milkshakes, how Greek migrants changed the culinary culture of rural Australia. You've been telling us about the Marble Bar Cafe in Grafton, the Niagara in Bega, and the Monterey in Coonamble. Plenty more as well on our Facebook page and on Twitter. So today, why so many rural Australians have fond memories of their local Greek cafe? That's coming up. Also, as the boats head back to the Gulf for another tiger prawn season, we give you an insight into what it's really like working as a deckhand on a trawler.
I'm really happy when we get a big bag of prawns, but I must admit that if I see one of my particularly interesting species of sea snakes hanging out of the side of that cotton, that's going to grab my attention a lot more and getting that snake out before it gets hurt.
How what the deckhands spot while they're on the job is helping scientists better understand the ocean. That's coming up today on Bush Telegraph. We start in the central west of New South Wales, where ceremonies have been held for today's 70th anniversary of the Cowra breakout. 231 Japanese and four Australian soldiers died in the mass escape at Cowra's POW camp. It was the only land battle fought on Australian soil in two world wars. Angela Owens is the morning's presenter with the local ABC radio station, and she's been at Cowra for the service. Hi, Ange, you're still awake?
Just, Cam, just. No, it was quite a special occasion, worth getting up early for.
Yeah, so it was 2 a.m. It would have been a chilly service. Who attended?
In fact, look, there were about 100 people there, which was not a bad effort, given it was a Monday night, early Tuesday morning, hovering around 0 degrees, Cam, very crisp, clear winter morning, not dissimilar to the conditions 70 years ago this morning. And in fact, the reason for the 2 a.m. start was that was when the Cowra breakout, when the 1,100 or so Japanese POWs stormed the barbed wire fences of the camp in basically what was a suicide mission.
So what's such a significant event in Australian history, in Australian war history? What's the mood been like in Cowra over the last few days?
Interesting. It's attracted a lot of people to the area, international guests as well, tourists and dignitaries, plenty of people, Japanese tourists and Japanese dignitaries. And if we remember that this particular event was something that Japanese people weren't taught in school at all, it was a very shameful part of Japanese history. The fact that there's been a big turning around, Cam, and there's busloads of tourists, basically, Japanese tourists, coming to Cowra for a couple of days of commemorations is really quite something. There's been a real buzz to the town. It's not a very big place, but this is certainly one of those events that's put Cowra on the map in terms of military history, significant events. It's, as you said, the only land battle fought on Australian soil in two world wars. So it's far from a celebration. It's a very sombre occasion, but a very important one to acknowledge.
So we'll hear a little more from the 2 a.m. service in just a moment. But you've been in Cowra since the weekend. What has the town been doing? What events have been on?
All sorts of things going on, from community parties, basically, to performances, art exhibition. A couple of big gun guest speakers in town, authors and historians Tom Keneally and Harry Gordon. Also up at the Cowra War Cemetery, where it's the only Japanese war cemetery in Australia. There have been wreath-laying ceremonies, a flyover, the wreath-laying for Australian and Japanese soldiers, a very special serving of tea to the war dead. That was on Sunday afternoon by a deputy tea master coming over from Japan for this occasion. One of the highlights, I would say, Cam, was 93-year-old Teruyu Murakami, who has been attending Cowra breakout anniversary events. This is his seventh visit, Cam. He's 93. He's a sprightly thing. But he is one of the last surviving Japanese POWs who was housed in Canberra and the only one well enough to make the trip to Australia. So it was very special to have him in town for this event. But I reckon, I have to say, one of the most powerful events was in the early hours this morning, out at the site. A bit of an eerie feeling. It was a very brief service to mark the moment the breakout started. The piece of audio we've got for you starts with Lawrence Ryan, the chair of the Akawa POW Breakout 70th Anniversary Committee.
Welcome to number 12 POW Camp Kaura. The date, Tuesday the 5th of August 2014. Time, approaching 2 a.m. Temperature, around 0 degrees. 70 years ago to the day since the fateful events of the Kaura breakout. As we stand here in the quiet stillness of an Australian winter night, it's hard to believe that this is the site of the only land battle fought on Australian soil during World War II. Yet here, exactly 70 years ago, a series of events that would forever change Kaura were about to begin. Rumours of a breakout by Japanese prisoners of war were not new. They had been heard around town since the Japanese began to arrive at the camp 18 months before. But now the POWs had been given the trigger for an incident. Within days, the Japanese prisoners of war population would be divided, with soldiers below the rank of Lance Corporal sent to the camp in far-off Hay. The decision would be the spark to light the flame, the reason needed by the Japanese to rebel against their captors and to die in a frantic charge at the perimeter fences that would erase the shame of captivity forever. The time for this charge would be 2 a.m. Just before 2 a.m, a lone POW races towards Broadway. He is waving frantically and screaming incoherently that something bad is about to happen. He approaches Private Alfred Roll, standing on the other side of the barbed wire. He is shivering with fear. Suddenly, a bugle call rings out from the Japanese huts, and over 1,000 prisoners of war charge from the burning buildings towards the perimeter fences. Private Roll stands for a moment transfixed before firing 2 warning shots into the air, the official warning of trouble within the camp. 3 flares light the night sky to alert the nearby military training camp. The Kaura POW breakout has begun. Close your eyes and imagine the fire. The machine guns firing. The screams of defiance, the cries of pain and the silence of death. 70 years ago to this minute, 1,104 Japanese prisoners of war took part in the Kaura breakout. In the final counting, 231 died, 107 were wounded and 334 escaped into the surrounding countryside. 4 Australians are killed and another 8 wounded. As you stand here tonight, remember those men who died at this spot at that time. Remember their fear, their inner torment. Remember their sacrifice for their countries and remember the horrors of war. But also remember that their terrible sacrifice was in itself a trigger in this town for something unique. For out of their sacrifice, their needless deaths has developed a sense of understanding, respect and reconciliation between nations that has produced the Kaura of today.
Private Alfred James Rolls was the first Australian soldier to realise something was happening at the Kaura POW camp on the 5th of August. His son, Gordon Rolls, was in Kaura for the commemorations and shared the rest of his father's story after those warning shots were fired.
The Japanese stormed out of the huts, stormed the fences and broke into Broadway, where Dad and them were standing. The order was given to run for your lives. So they ran to the southern end of Broadway and just got out in time to lock the gates behind them. The Japanese informer, who they said was a Japanese who came to warn Dad what was going to happen, didn't run with them and the Japanese killed him.
Was it something he talked much about, Gordon?
Not a lot, because when it all happened and they went to court for the inquiries and everything, everything was sort of, they were told to only answer the questions that they were asked and basically not to talk too much. And as you said, well, there was 4 of us in Broadway at the time, but there was only 3 of us with rifles. So he said, we're completely outnumbered. When we got out of Broadway, we fired shots back into Broadway. But he said, and no prisoner escaped at the southern end of Broadway.
It wasn't just Australians sharing their stories. One of the last surviving Japanese prisoners of war, 93-year-old Mr. Teruyu Murakami, made the journey from Japan to Kaura. He was a man of little words, but through his translator, historian and researcher Mami Yamada, he did say why it was important for him to be in town for commemorations.
I have to do the prayers for those who lost their lives, my former comrades. That's the first thing I have to do.
Mami Yamada has spent a lot of years with Mr. Murakami and other Japanese POWs recording their stories. She said there are two main things they want to get across to the Australian people.
Yesterday, I was with Mr. Murakami, of course, and I was asking so many questions about the breakout. And I asked him, what is your feeling right now? Mm-hmm. And he said that I want to apologize to the people in Australia to make this breakout. And then, just after that, he came to, where was it? It was Information Center.
Yes.
There was a guest book, and he started to write something, and I was watching, and he put five letters in English, in Japanese. It said, arigato. It means thank you. So I think sorry and thank you are the two things Mr. Murakami wanted to mm-hmm. convey to the people of Australia, and I think that's exactly the thing that many other POWs also want to say to Australian people who were very, very kind all the time, even during the wartime, to the Japanese POWs.
But today's anniversary is not only about remembering the tragic events in Kaura. It's about reflecting on the friendship that has been forged between Japan and Kaura and how to sustain this into the future. Kaura resident Bruce Weir was 16 when the breakout occurred. He and his family had two encounters with escaped POWs seeking refuge on their property. His mother amazed locals with her generosity towards the Japanese captives, serving them tea and scones before letting the army take them back to camp. Bruce recalled what the relationship between the two people was like 70 years ago.
It was a very tentative period. There were people had very strong feelings about the Japanese and what they had caused in the Pacific. I was terrified of them, I have to say, but I would like to think that misunderstanding that was evident in 1944 between the two peoples, the Japanese and the Australians, has somewhat been alleviated by the events that have happened in Kaura in the intervening years since. I'd like to think also that what my mother did, metaphorically speaking, was the forging of the first link in a very long chain of events that enabled the building of that bridge across the gap of misunderstanding.
The respect, understanding and reconciliation between Japan and Kaura has been evident across the commemorations. Japanese Ambassador to Australia, Mr. Yoshitaka Akimoto, reflected on this friendship.
On the evening of the 5th of August 1944, a tragic event took place in Kaura. However, over the last 70 years, this event of sadness and pain has steadily developed into a symbol of reconciliation and friendship between our two countries. During the last 70 years, Japanese Cemetery, Japanese Garden, Cherry Avenue, and Peace Pathway have been built in Kaura. At the same time, former POWs from the camps in Australia and Japan, together with other Australian and Japanese returned servicemen, have extended a hand of friendship and have steadily promoted reconciliation. I would like to express my heartfelt thanks and respect to all of those people who overcame the tragic events of the past and made selfless efforts to honor the memory of those who lost their lives during the breakout. In doing so, they have made an invaluable contribution to the reconciliation of the two countries.
The Kaura breakout isn't the only significant military anniversary at the moment. Yesterday marked 100 years since the start of World War One. A ceremony in town was the focal point of New South Wales's commemorations. It was attended by dignitaries from around the world, including Lieutenant General Ken Gillespie, who is the chair of the New South Wales Centenary of ANZAC Advisory Council.
In the early days of the Centenary of ANZAC Advisory Council, we were trying very hard to work out what it was that we wanted the state to get out of the centenary period. And we really could have just said, what Kaura's got is what we want. A history built on tragedy. That tragedy led to people coming together, of learning, of understanding, of education, of friendship, and making a real legacy out of that, set of tragic events. And the important part is that it involves the whole of the community. That involves school children, education, tourism. It's a wonderful legacy. And so if we can have other communities around the state doing what Cara has done today and over the week remembering the breakout, then we'll have a pretty special centenary period.
Lieutenant General Ken Gillespie, who's chair of the New South Wales Centenary of ANZAC Advisory Council, speaking there to Angela Owens from ABC Local Radio. Angie's still with me. Angie, you're obviously familiar with a lot of the history around this event, being in the region, but how has the last few days and last night in particular changed your understanding of the events?
Look, it's been a powerful experience. It's one of those things, Cam, I'm sure you've experienced many times as well, where history comes to life. It comes off the pages. And hearing voices like Bruce Weir talk about his mum and the compassion and kindness she showed. And I don't know if you remember the famous photo there of the POWs drinking tea in the back of a truck. Hearing those stories from regional people, who many of whom have lost loved ones, who have been in Japanese POW camps themselves during World War II. It wasn't an easy process. It's not an automatic thing that the Japanese and the Australian people would have this point of friendship that they talk about so strongly now. So understanding how that happened was really important for me, and how a community heals. And it doesn't, my sense is that it doesn't happen quickly. It takes decades and decades for that. And that there are lots of things that you need that sort of those physical reminders around the place. And I guess Cowra has got the beautiful Japanese gardens, the cherry blossoms, the avenue there, the war cemetery, and the peace bell. I don't know if you know, there's only one of seven bronze peace bells in the world, UN peace bell, in Cowra's central area. It's the only one in Australia. And there's lots of events that happen around that. That's that sort of constant reminder about the commitment to peace and reconciliation.
And well, thank you for giving us a better understanding of the history and what's taken place just last night and the last few days as well. There's I see there's some pictures up on the website, abc.net.au/centralwest. I've sent them out on Twitter as well. Thanks a lot, Angie. You better get some sleep, huh?
Yeah, thanks, Cam.
Angela Owens, who's the morning's presenter at the local ABC radio station in the central west of New South Wales. Let's head north now and join fishing boats in the Gulf of Carpentaria, where the deckhands on these boats are playing a vital role in making sure there will be plenty of fish for the future. The northern prawn fishery is one of just seven in Australia to have achieved what's called a blue tick from the Marine Stewardship Council. That tick is a global standard. It's used to certify that seafood is caught sustainably in the wild. But it's up to the deckhands in the Gulf to collect the data that contributes to the blue tick for the northern tiger prawn fisheries. As the boats headed out into the Gulf this week, Charlie McKillop found out that being a crew member means much more than just catching prawns.
A net bursting at the seams full of prawns is a sight every deckhand on every prawn trawler is excited to see. Cherie Carton's been fishing in the Gulf of Carpentaria now for 20 years, and when those nets are spilled onto the sorting tray, it's not only prawns she's looking for.
I'm really happy when we get a big bag of prawns, but I must admit that if I see one of my particularly interesting species of sea snakes hanging out of the side of that cod end, that's going to grab my attention a lot more, and getting that snake out before it gets hurt and thrown back over the side. This just makes the job a lot more interesting. I don't think I would have stayed in fishing for 20 years if I hadn't become involved in the Crew Member Observer program. It adds a whole new dimension. 4 months, 4.5 months, is a long time to be at sea.
And that was crustaceans.
The Crew Member Observer program's been running in the northern prawn fishery for the past 10 years. Cherie's been there from the start and is now involved in training other CMOs in the correct way to collect and record data.
You write down the times of the shots, and then on the back, do an estimate of the size.
Yep. My name's Josh, and I'll be fishing on Lady Serene, and I'll be collecting data for Soro and AFMA.
You've done the induction course in the last couple of days. How has that prepared you for what you are about to do?
It's made me understand a lot more about the fishery and past seasons. Whatever comes up, usually you don't pay any attention to it at all, what it is or whether it's threatened or endangered or whatever, and it just goes back over the side and that's the end of that, and you just carry on fishing, you know. So it adds a new aspect to fishing.
Why is that something that you're seeking?
It's just something that's always been in the back of my mind, sort of helping out with this sort of thing, you know. And yeah, and I've been given the opportunity and I can't wait to do it.
It's a co-management success story that's being held up as an example of how fishers can play a meaningful role in the decisions about their fishery.
I've definitely noticed that in the last 10 years there's been quite a big change in attitude amongst people that were nervous that we were providing information that was just going to be used to shut down the fishery by, you know, quote-unquote greenies. And now people realise that that information is really valuable to make informed decisions about the fishery and to present evidence to the general public or to the governing bodies that in a lot of areas we're seeing an increase in our prawn catches through lowering the fishing effort by, you know, lowering the number of boats and out there. We're actually, it's improving. And if we weren't collecting the data that we are, they wouldn't be able to see a lot of that sort of things. You know, they see that we're not damaging the population of certain kinds of fish or other crustaceans. In fact, in some places they're thriving.
And it's being recognised not only by industry, but the scientists and fishery managers are on board as well. Gary Fry works for the Oceans and Atmosphere section of the Commonwealth Scientific Industry Research Organisation, otherwise known as CSIRO.
Data is expensive to collect when you're out on board a vessel. With crew member observers, you train up. We got 10 crew member observers this year. And to get that kind of data from the whole fishing season, it's invaluable. You collect a lot more data. We validate the data when it comes in by looking at the animals they're collecting. So we identify each one because they collect photos from each animal they record. We also do a sort of validation of their data, you know, comparing catch rates that they collect when they're out collecting the information and what we've collected in our scientific surveys.
So it's much more than just a feel-good exercise for the industry.
Yeah, that's right. It's when the crew member observers collect that data, the industry sends that data to a copy of that data to us. Once we verify that data, we use it in running risk assessments and sustainability analysis on that data to see to look at catch rates over time. You know, if the catch rates are steady, that's a good indication that nothing's changing. If the catch rates are going down, you know, there's scenarios where the fishery has changed regions where the high effort is, or actually the animals are decreasing in numbers. But you know, till we know that, we need to verify the data and look at the fishery patterns.
Gary Fry from the CSIRO, speaking at a workshop that was in Cairns for new crew member observers working on prawn trawlers in the Gulf. Charlie McKillop with that report. We'll find out what's making rural news in just a moment with Tony Allen, but I just wanted to clear up a statement made yesterday before we get to that when we were speaking with our national reporter, Serena Locke, about Landcare Australia. Serena suggested that Rio Tinto was one of the sponsors of Landcare Australia. That's not the case anymore. Up next, today's rural news. I've just found out that Angela Pippos, who would be well known to ABC viewers and listeners, has a background or family background in Greek cafes in rural Australia. Angela has told us on Twitter at RNBushTelly, my papu worked at a cafe in Mullumbimby in the 1950s. My other papu owned a cafe on Norwood Parade, which I think is Adelaide. I don't think we can claim that as rural. But the reason I'm discussing that is because later in the program, we are talking about the legacy of Greek cafes on rural Australia. There's an exhibition on at the moment about this. And if I go by your feedback on our Facebook page and our Twitter account, lots of you have memories of Greek cafes in your country town as well. So stay with us for that. First, though, Tony Allen's got today's rural news. Tony, factory farming in Port Augusta, but with a twist.
Yes, by 2018, Port Augusta's going to have a new industry, breeding sterile fruit flies.
Mm.
Now, we have mentioned this before, that they're going to build a I suppose you'd call it a factory or factory farming to breed these fruit flies. They're aiming to get 50 million bred a week. At the moment, there are places in New South Wales that can breed about 12 or 15 million sterile fruit flies a week. Apparently, that's not enough. The new thing about this is that Horticulture Australia, which is the research and development corporation for the fruit and vegetable industry, is contributing $11 million, half the funding of this plant, because it sees the need to dramatically increase research on fruit flies. Fruit flies cost Australian fruit and veg farmers about $300 million a year in lost markets. And there's a worry it's going to get worse because the main chemical control for Queensland fruit fly, a chemical called phenthione, is likely to be phased out in the next year or so because of concerns about how it affects humans. So David Moore, the head of research at Horticulture Australia, says releasing these sterile insects to breed and thus reduce the fruit fly populations, it isn't used much here, but it is widely used around the world.
The reason it hasn't been used in Australia before is the cost and I suppose the fragmentation of approach to controlling fruit flies. In combination with an area-wide management approach, it does work. It may not give us eradication, but it's going to get us to a point where we hope that fruit flies won't be an issue in trade negotiations.
And where he says fragmentation of approach, he's referring to the fact that fruit flies are generally controlled on a state basis, but the flies themselves don't know that.
And not too concerned with borders.
No, yeah. They're not too concerned with borders, and it has caused problems, and they're working on a national strategy at last.
I want to find out more about this fly farming. 50 million a week, that is a lot of flies. And I remember just recently we had a story about a fly farm, or fly factory if you prefer, in South Africa, and that had Australian investors. That was for a different reason. That was to grow them as a protein source.
So. And how do you breed sterile ones?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting that they want to breed both male and female sterile flies. Apparently it's easier to breed the males, but the holy grail of sterile fruit fly farming is to breed sterile females.
Really? Okay. We need to find out more. I think that's a really interesting story. Let's go to Victoria now. The Premier in Victoria has ruled out fracking in certain areas. What's happening here?
Well, we've mentioned in a number of other states the concern about coal seam gas mining and shale mining and other forms of mining. They are going to be using fracking in places like the Northern Territory. Well, Dennis Napthine, the Premier of Victoria, met with farmers yesterday in Western Victoria to ease their concerns about hydraulic fracking, which they feared could be introduced in Victoria. He says all prime agricultural land will be protected from unconventional gas mining, that's code for fracking. And he says the state government's primary objective is to maintain a global reputation for clean, green agriculture and to protect underground water supplies.
The coalition has made it very clear, no fracking under our government, and we're moving legislation to ban the use of BTEX chemicals. We are concerned as a state to do the proper research and make sure if there's any proposals that may impact on underground water supplies, we have the knowledge base to deal with it.
There's some similarities between fracking control and fruit fly control, isn't there? Real differences between the states. Each come up with their own approach. Let's finish up with a story around live exports, live cattle exports. They could be heading out from a port on Cape York again.
Yes, Weipa is better known as an aluminium port, but until 3 years ago, it did export live cattle from northwest Queensland. That stopped 3 years ago when the suspension of live exports to Indonesia happened. It never resumed. But they've now formed a working group to try and resurrect the trade. One of the drivers of this working group is Cameron Quatermain from Watson River Station near Weipa. He actually helped build the Weipa yards, cattle yards himself, and he says a number of exporters are interested once the price improves for export cattle.
If they're going to send the cattle through Townsville, they're heading the wrong way. They're not heading towards Southeast Asia that way. They're heading towards the South Pole. So it'd be better sense if you were going to, you know, hopefully get a better price at Weipa and, you know, send your cattle north. We've got our cattle sitting in the paddock waiting at the moment. If we can get a good price structure, we'll be the first ones on with the cattle.
That's a weeper view of the world, isn't it, if Townsville's heading to the South Pole?
That's right. Tell people in Brisbane and Sydney that they're on the way to the South Pole.
Let's leave it there, Tony. Thanks a lot. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. abc.net.au/rural is the website that's updated right throughout the day with more news, like those live cattle exports from Weeper, potentially. Before we talk about Greek milkshakes and mixed grills and the legacy of Greek cafes on rural Australia, let's get some music. This is new by a Melbourne-based producer called Fifths, and it features vocals by Jared Clapper. It's the debut track called Sell It To Me.
Tell me true.
That's new by Fifths, featuring vocals by Jared Clover. The track's called Sell It To Me. You're listening to Bush Telegraph, RN and Radio Australia. I'm Cameron Wilson. Well, the milk bar, the milkshake and the mixed grill, the reason we have them here in Australia is because of Greek migrants. They either invented them or brought them to Australia from abroad, transforming Australia's food culture, especially in country towns. Now an exhibition is paying homage to the colourful milkshake cups and deep-fried meats and the people who made it all possible. Joe Bark is curator at the National Museum, and Leonard Januszewski is with the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University. Welcome to you both. Joe, I'll start with you. You've got an exhibit in the National Museum in Canberra looking at one Greek cafe in particular, the Busy Bee in Gunnedah. What's in that exhibit?
Look, we've got an array of the bits and bobs that were used in the cafe. So the anodized milkshake containers, the syrup dispensers, but also some of the fixtures and fittings from the cafe in an attempt to sort of capture the Art Deco style of these cafes.
So they tend to have that a consistent style, do they, the Art Deco style?
It was certainly the kind of the height of popularity, I think, of the cafes, and in the 30s a lot of them refitted their cafes in the Art Deco style. And there was actually a Greek shop fitter by the name of Vavaressos who designed a lot of the interiors of the cafes, so there was a real consistency across them.
Mm-hmm. How did you come across the memorabilia from the Busy Bee Cafe?
Well, actually, that was thanks to Leonard. So the work that Leonard has done, and I'll let him tell you about that, but the Busy Bee Cafe in Gunnedah was closing down, and Leonard put us in touch with the owners who were looking to dispose of the contents of the cafe.
Mm-hmm. Leonard, how important were or are Greek cafes to Australian country towns?
Important. They were the focus of country towns. They were the social life. They were the eating venues. It's where gossip took place. It's where people took their first dates to. It's where they went before the movies, during the movies. They were central to life in country towns throughout Australia, East Coast, West Coast, even up north in the Northern Territory.
So could I say they were also where country Australians got their first taste of Greek food?
Well, no, I wouldn't put that argument forward. Certainly, there were attempts to get Greek food in terms of sweets and so on from the 1930s onwards, but it wasn't successful. What was successful were the American products and American technology which they brought over, and then they mixed with what they found within Australia, such as the mixed grill and so on. So it was a hybridisation, utilising milkshakes, utilising sodas, bringing them out to Australia, and then by the 1940s creating hamburgers and adding that to the mixed grill. So basically it was a story of transference and then transformation.
So this is why you've got a travelling exhibition called Selling an American Dream to Australia's Greek Cafe. Can you tell me more about that connection between the Greek cafes in Australia and the United States?
Well, look, the story is part of the Greek diaspora, which was global. Greeks have been migrating from Greece since at least the 3rd century BC, and indeed it continued in the modern era. In the United States, there was a large number of Greeks who left Greece, particularly the northern Peloponnese, Arcadia, and went across to the United States. They found a diversity of working areas that they went into, mining, railroads, but many of them went into food catering. And what they got from there was the technology, but what they introduced into the United States was the idea that eating is not structured according to the social level. So if you're well-to-do, you went to a French restaurant, and if you were a working class, you went to a blue-collar establishment such as an oyster saloon, which incidentally were originally British. What they thought was, let's have a family focus. So they mixed that idea with what they found in the States, in regard to your milkshakes and your sodas and your American-style ice cream, which had a hit of sugar in it, as well as American-style milk chocolate. And that was very successful. They went across the US from the East Coast to the West Coast, and then by the 1910s, there were quite a large number of Greek Americans who had actually established businesses here. And they were predominantly Arcadians and later on Cytherians. But indeed, the story of the transference took the entire century, that is the 20th century. There were still ideas coming across. So it's the movement of people and ideas across the continent that was important in terms of picking up the ideas from the US and then implanting them within Australia. Australia was basically manifest destiny. They looked across the Pacific and there we were.
So before the arrival of the Greek Cafe, were you hard-pressed to find either a milkshake or sweet ice cream in Australia?
Not a milkshake. Milkshakes have been around since at least the 1880s. In fact, the first use of the term was in Harper's Bazaar in 1885 or 89. Milkshakes, as the term suggests, were a liquid refreshment that was shaken in a bottle or a glass. And you had a little bit of vanilla essence, you had some ice, you had some cold milk and so on. But it wasn't until the revolution of the Hamilton Beach milkshake make that was originally created for the creation of malted milks rather than milkshakes, and there is a difference.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
Oh, basically it was just malt placed within milk. But a milkshake, the early milkshakes were much, much more. They derived from apothecaries or early chemists that in the United States became drugstore soda parlours. And within them, you didn't get the type of milkshake that we see today. The milkshake that we see today is a product of the 1950s. Fat-saturated, sugar-saturated. Emphasis on taste and emphasis to try and create as many units as possible to sell. When they were first created, they were a health food. They were promoted as a health drink.
It seems incredible.
It is. Fresh eggs, you had raw chocolate, you had various types of fruit, both dried and fresh. You also had, and the most popular in this country, was the bootlegger punch. It either had a dash of rum essence in it, or some proprietors, even though you really need a liquor license to provide this, rum itself. And it was only sold for fourpence during the early part of the century. And so it was relatively cheap, particularly during the Depression years. And, Cameron, there was even a time when the Australian Hoteliers Association were getting up in arms because so many men were leaving the pubs, particularly during the Depression, going across to the milk bar because they could get a swig of rum in their milkshake much cheaper than they could over at the pub. And the pubs were selling milkshakes for ninepence without the rum.
Joe, Leonard's doing a good job of telling us all the good things that Greek migrants brought to country towns, but how were they accepted when they arrived in fairly small places around New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria?
Look, I think from my experience, they seem to have integrated reasonably well into the town, because really what they did was become part of the fabric of the country town. They weren't introducing kind of new crazy ideas. I guess things might have been different if they were producing Greek food for a Greek clientele. Perhaps they would have set themselves up more in opposition to the locals. But really what they were doing was catering to the locals. They were open from, you know, 7 in the morning till 11 midnight. And so the locals, if they were coming to town for the stock sales, to do business or whatever, there was a place for them to go. So the Greeks really became, I guess, appreciated for what services they offered.
What prior to that was at the pub, if the pub was open for lunch or dinner, and that was about it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so they obviously bought that service that was needed. Some of the names are interesting. They're not particularly Greek sounding, a lot of the cafes. Any reason for that?
Well, I think as Leonard said, there are sort of two types of naming traditions, and one is that there are some called Arcadia or Olympia, and then there are others which really reflect that American tradition. So the Niagara Cafe, for example.
Mm. We put this out on Twitter at RNBushTelly this morning for people to share their memories of the Greek cafe in their town. And one that was brought up or pointed out to us was Cafe Deluxe in Brewarrina. So we got hold of Angelo Pipos, who is the owner of Cafe Deluxe. Hi, Angelo.
Good morning, Cameron. How are you?
Good. How long's the cafe been in your family?
Since 1926. Dad opened the cafe in 26.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the story? Why do you know why he decided to open the cafe?
Well, I don't know. He had a cafe in Mungandoi, Gundawindi, Doorumbandy. Then he came to Bawarana, and somehow he kept somebody looked after the other cafes, and he brought his brothers out from Greece and gave them one of those cafes each.
So what, he was literally just driving from one town to the next thinking this is
a
good spot for a cafe?
Well, I don't know. He never spoke too much about it.
Was the cafe he ran, was it similar to what we're hearing about? Mixed grills, steak sandwiches,
yes,
not so
exactly
much the Greek food?
Exactly the same
yeah.
in those days, yes, and still the same today. We still cut our own chips, potatoes, we still make our own squashes, we still make our own syrups for the milkshakes and ice creams, and you know, everything's still the same as in 1926.
What was it like as a kid growing up around the cafe?
We had to work before we went to school and come home and did our chores as soon as we got home, and we didn't have much social life.
Oh, you're working by the sound of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't hurt us.
Yeah, what sort of work did you do, Angela?
In those days?
Yeah.
Well, we used to scrub the floor before we went to school. It was a lino floor in those days. And when we came home, we were working on the tables.
Okay, so wake up, scrub the floor, go to school, wait the tables.
Yeah.
It's a hard way to to be
it was
brought
the
up.
Same with, the, you know, I had a brother and three sisters, and it was the same for the whole lot
so
of it.
You've all chipped in. I was saying earlier that Angela Pipos, who is background with the ABC, has been in contact with us on Twitter, saying that you'll find a Pipos Cafe in Queensland, New South Wales, South Australia. They're everywhere. It's in our
everywhere
blood.
Everywhere now, yeah.
So have you changed anything, or do you still, have you just kept to that tried
no,
and tested
still,
approach?
Still the same. Yeah. Still the same. Nothing's changed.
You're clearly well known. The National Irrigators Council requested I ask this question of you. How you managed to convince Mary, the beautiful flight attendant, to move to Brewarrina?
She's a local girl, and we went to the primary school together here. Then she got sent away to boarding school in Sydney, and I got sent away to boarding school in Bathurst, and 40-odd years later she came back for a school reunion, and that was it.
Margie, my apologies for that.
So
you've stayed. Yeah. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. We're discussing the history of the Greek cafe in Australia. Angelo Pipos is who you're hearing from there, Cafe Deluxe, from Cafe Deluxe in Brewarrina. I've also been chatting with Joanne Bark, the curator of the Australian Society in History at the National Museum of Australia, and Leonard Yanichevsky, who is from the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University. Leonard, that's the story you told there. Angelo repeating exactly what you told us, so it sounds like you got it right.
Oh, that's right. We interviewed Angelo and his family quite a number of years ago. And indeed, look, I will say regarding the Cafe Deluxe, it is a very fine example of a soda parlour when it was established in 1928. Milk bars didn't become popular until the 1930s. But indeed, when you walk into that place, it is a time warp. We were absolutely amazed. Angelo probably told you they've still got the younger stove, which they were originally using back in 1926. They still use the same crockery cutlery, clean, of course. The interior just blew us away, and they've got the original soda fountain counter with this wonderful back bar behind, which indicates that they provide civility and service and, of course, cheap prices.
Some of the pictures, photographs that you've sent us through, we've got one up on our Facebook page now of the, I think it's the Busy Bee, also some others as well. The presentation of the cafes themselves, but also the men in the photo I'm looking at here, is just incredible. People in rural Australia must have wondered what was going on when they first laid eyes on this.
Most certainly. Look, it was a very clever combination of food and fantasy, and that was an idea brought across from the United States. Joe mentioned earlier, talking about Art Deco, in the Busy Bee itself, that's an example of early European-style Art Deco, which was angular, that Varvaressos was utilising as an outfitter of Greek cafes. But later came streamlined modern from the United States, and people would recognise that in terms of the curvilinear style. It was also known as the ship style down here. So the architecture of the place was part of the fantasy. In terms of uniforms, because the Greeks went away from the stratification of eating, no, look, if you want to eat, the whole family's invited, don't care whether or
or not you're from the upper class or the working class, all come in. So they got rid of uniforms that suggested people were servants. And what they did, they started branding. So you'd find that in the uniforms, they will have colours that are also the colours of the logo of the actual cafes themselves. So they're making a clear statement. We are different. We are here. We will provide all of you with the type of service that you would expect from fine dining. And so it was part of the fantasy, and indeed the fantasy extended, because jukeboxes, when they were introduced, when the Americans were out here during the war, 1940s, they found a little piece of America in these cafes and milk bars, but hey, where is the music? So jukeboxes were coming in, and you heard swing, jazz, right up to rock and roll, even before it was being played on the radio itself. This was the time of radio dramas. And of course, people would remember also, the cinemas were connected to the cafe. Some Greek milk bars and cafes were in the cinemas themselves. And so there was another relationship between food and fantasy. So yes, what these country folk were being offered in Australia was a little piece of the modern, a little piece of the United States, a little piece of exotica, which many of them couldn't even dream about in terms of experiencing by going over there. But here was a piece of it in their own country town in Australia.
Christine Young got in touch with us on Twitter at 2EACH, and Christine said, the Great Northern Cafe at Maitland, New South Wales, apparently my grandfather owned it, I take it from what she's saying, and offered neither Coke or a jukebox to keep the riffraff away. So it sounds like some people shunned the American influence.
Yes, in actual fact, milk bars and cafes had to make a decision when you had your bodgies and wedgies on their motorbikes. Many of them were considered to be hoons and creating a possible threat to other customers. This was the period when Australian society was changing and there was more disposable cash for those who were younger within our society. Their influence was emerging. And some milk bars and cafes decided to let go of jukeboxes and so on, because they did not want to have the youth culture disturbing the family orientation of their businesses. And that would be dependent upon whether or not they're in major cities or country towns, and the number of customers that they were serving and the character of the customers they were serving.
Angelo, what approach did you take? Did you try to steer clear of the bodgies and widgies?
Well, there wasn't that many around here. We had a jukebox, of course, for years, and we don't have one now. But we never had any trouble. No trouble whatsoever.
We've got a question here. Are you related to Jerry Pipos, who had the cafe in Dirranbandi, southwest of Queensland?
Cousin.
So you all related in one way or another, are you?
Yeah, somehow, I think. All the ones in Queensland and New South Wales, though, and some of the ones in South Australia.
But Joe Bark, is that what you see? You just see this family connection from one cafe to the next, where maybe you had the father who travelled from town to town opening cafes?
Yeah, certainly Angelo's stories really kind of sums up that experience of lots of Greeks that came out. And it's a pattern that is known as chain migration. So, you know, two brothers would come out and they would work hard, they would buy a business, they would build it up, they would sponsor another brother or a cousin who would come out, who would work hard, and in a way would almost then sort of move to the next town on the train line, set up a business. And so this is a real pattern, and it's not just family members, but it's people from the same village too. So sometimes you would get people with the same name who are not related by blood, but we're related by location, and we're from the same village on Kithara often, and there was a really strong connection there.
So it's not by any means just a New South Wales phenomenon. The question was asked of me this morning if this is something unique to New South Wales, but clearly not, Joe.
No, I believe Angelo's already mentioned, you know, southern Queensland. I think the strongest concentration is certainly New South Wales, because the arrival port was Sydney. So people then kind of fanned out from Sydney. But certainly, you know, South Australia, Western Australia, Victoria and Queensland. And I think you mentioned before Darwin as well. Look, you know, wherever there was a business opportunity, there was a canny Greek that was prepared to open a cafe.
Angela, you said earlier you still hand cut the chips and the handmade syrups. Any plans to change, or you'll keep going the traditional way?
No, still the same.
Yeah?
It'll stay.
That's what brings people through the days. Well, I better let you go. It's just about lunchtime, huh? Angelo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Cameron.
Angelo Pipos from Cafe Deluxe in Brewarrina. Joanne Bark, my thanks to you from the National Museum of Australia. And Leonard Januszewski from Macquarie University. Just very quickly, the touring at the moment, the exhibition, Leonard?
Yes, it is. At the moment, it's at Hurstville City Museum and Gallery, and it'll be running there until the 28th of September.
Great. All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much, Leonard.
Thank you very much.
Leonard Januszewski, who's, as I said, from the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University. We'll make sure there's some links up on our webpage to that travelling exhibition if you are interested. And we do have quite a handful of fantastic photographs from inside Greek cafes around country Australia. We'll put them up on the Bush Telegraph website very soon, so check that out as well. That's the program for today. You're on RN. News is next.
Some 4,000 mentally ill patients will start moving out of institutions in New South Wales into community hostels and group homes.
An alternative community-based service focuses on client needs rather than on the needs of the institution.
Treatment and even definitions of mental illness have changed enormously since the time of the Victorian asylums. That story coming up on Rear Vision with me, Kerry Phillips. And you can download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.